This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
So welcome, everybody. Let me start by introducing myself. My name is Kim Barr. I'm a genetic counselor from Kaiser in San Francisco, and I've been there for 25 years. I did clinical for many years and recently changed over to do genetics education for our entire region in Northern California. I'll be presenting along with Dr. Emily Chen.
And I'm a geneticist at Kaiser Permanente in San Francisco, and I'm also a clinical professor at UCSF. And I've been at Kaiser for about 12 years. I previously trained at UCSF as a fellow in genetics.
Our talk tonight is focused on Down syndrome. We're going to take this journey into the past and then bring you into the present in our understanding of Down syndrome. And we're going to do that with the help of this wonderful panel of experts, the real experts on the topic of Down syndrome. Let me introduce our panel very quickly. So we have three individuals who themselves have Down syndrome. If you could raise your hand when I mention your name, Joseph Vaughn.
Hi.
Jackson Steele. And Marissa Erickson. And we have their mothers with them. Eleanor Vaughn, Jane Steiner, and Mary Erickson. I'm trying to go from memory here. In addition, we have two people from the Wayfinders program in Fresno, Lorna Ugali and Ryan Wilson. And their program is a program that helps young adults who are in school to do some lifelong learning beyond the high school period. So I'm going to start with a question to you guys. What do you think about when you hear Down syndrome? Take a moment and think about some of the things that come to your mind. For many people that I talk with, the first thing that comes to mind is the intellectual disabilities, the learning issues, or perhaps the physical differences that make Down syndrome recognizable. But how many of you thought about football players, homecoming princesses, airplane pilots, about college students, or senior citizens? Tonight we want to challenge your perception of Down syndrome and leave you with a more balanced perspective of what Down syndrome is and what it isn't. We're going to cover a lot of changes that have happened in the past 30 to 40 years of Down syndrome, starting with what Down syndrome is and how we diagnose it, looking at some of the medical changes and the healthcare improvements that have happened during that time, talking about the changes in educational opportunities for people with Down syndrome, and finally, looking at the support resources that are available for these individuals. So we're going to start at the beginning. What is Down syndrome? How do we figure out who has it? Well, it's a well-recognized condition. The first person to ever put into writing the physical features that go along with Down syndrome was Dr. John Langdon Down. He was a physician in England in the late 1800s, and he was the first to put that in writing, first to describe all the different features. And it was 100 years later, almost, that we named the syndrome after the first person who described it, which is where the term Down syndrome comes from. But it's around everywhere. One in every 700 babies born has Down syndrome, and it affects people of all ethnicities. It's estimated that about 6 million people worldwide have Down syndrome. It's common. We know that it's related to the mother's age. As a woman's age increases, the chance for having a baby with Down syndrome also increases. But the average maternal age is 31 when a baby with Down syndrome is born. What that means is some women are younger, some are older. Women of any age can have a baby with Down syndrome. To talk about where this came from, it took us another almost 100 years after it was first described to figure out what was causing Down syndrome. We know this is a chromosome condition. It was first described in 1959 by Lejeune. So I'm going to do a little, I'm a genetic counselor, I love genetics, give you some background, some primer on genetics. If we think about our cells in the body, every cell in our body has a full set of the genetic instructions. The genome. That's everything that came from your parents. That set of instruction is packaged in chromosomes. Each individual chromosome has hundreds to thousands of individual genes, individual genetic instructions. And when we look at this set under a microscope, this is the kind of picture we'll see. What we do in the laboratory is line those chromosomes up in a way that we can look at them more carefully. And we number them so that we can talk about them from person to person and it makes sense. The way we number is from largest to smallest. Chromosome number 1 is the largest in the cell. Chromosomes 21 and 22, the smallest. And when we line them up, you can see that they're paired. One of those pairs came from mom. One of the pairs came from dad. And if you happen to notice over in this corner here, There is a pair that we don't use a number for. That's the sex chromosome pair. That pair is different in males and females. This is an example of a male, X and a Y. A female would have two X's. The total number of chromosomes that we see is 46 in the typical human cell. However, in someone who has Down syndrome, there's one small difference. Instead of having 46, there are 47 chromosomes in every cell of the body. And that extra chromosome happens to be extra chromosome 21. The medical term for Down syndrome is trisomy 21. That just means three chromosome 21s. It's a description of what we see in the laboratory. That extra chromosome 21 was finally sequenced in 2000, not even 15 years ago, where we finally figured out what are the genes on that chromosome. Turns out there's 225 genes. That little addition of those 225 genes changes development in a very predictable way that we call Down syndrome. So when we look at this picture, about 95% of individuals with Down syndrome have this kind of set of chromosomes with that extra chromosome 21. Much less common is what we call a translocation chromosome 21, or translocation Down syndrome. What's happening in this picture is that same extra chromosome 21 is there, but it's actually attached to another chromosome. In this example, it's chromosome 14, but there are others that it can attach to. So when we're looking at the cells, there's still only 46. That's the typical number, but there's still three copies of chromosome 21, and that still changes development in the same way as having three copies that are separate. That leads to the inheritance of Down syndrome. A lot of people ask, where did this come from? How did this happen? It's one of the questions we get a lot when I'm talking with families. Most cases of trisomy 21 happen completely out of the blue. They're random. They're not expected. They're not in the family history. They didn't happen in any other children in the family. And in fact, when we see it once, we know the chance for a second child with Down syndrome is still pretty low, usually less than 1%. The reason we pay attention to the translocation is sometimes that can run in a family. About half the time, it happens the same way that the extra chromosome trisomy 21 happens, random, an error that takes place when the egg or sperm is being formed. More recently, questions have come up because there are women with Down syndrome who have children. So people will say, well, what would happen if my daughter with Down syndrome had a child? It turns out that there have been parents with Down syndrome. And we find that the risk for females to have a child with Down syndrome is about 30 to 50%. The numbers for males are less certain. There's only a handful of men who've had children, and fertility seems to be an issue. But it's a question that may come up a lot more in the future. We know what causes it, that extra chromosome 21. We know it's kind of random. How do we make that diagnosis? The diagnosis before 1970 was made the same way Dr. Downs made it in 1866, by physical differences, by noticing those changes when a child is born. So here we are 100 years later doing the same thing that was being done previously. It wasn't until 1970 that the first prenatal testing option was introduced. That first test was a test called amniocentesis, and for the first time we could get cells from a fetus and look at them under the microscope to see how many chromosomes were present. At that time, they were only offering this to women who were considered high risk. This is women who were 35 or older or had a history of Down syndrome in the family. So most diagnoses were still being made after delivery. That all changed in the 80s. What happened in the 80s was we developed the first routine screening test. A test we were actually using for something else entirely could tell us something about a pregnancy with Down syndrome. So at this point, we started to shift to more diagnoses being made during pregnancy. And then the 90s came. In the 90s, the biggest change that happened was our technology in ultrasound dramatically improved. We were starting to notice subtle differences from baby to baby, fetus to fetus, and we would identify some of those differences were more common in a fetus with Down syndrome. So we were using those ultrasound markers that weren't necessarily birth defects, just differences, to identify those pregnancies that were more likely to have Down syndrome. And by the 2000s, we had put all of that together and improved the kinds of blood work we could look at, the kinds of ultrasound markers we could identify. And by this point, almost all diagnoses of Down syndrome were able to be made during pregnancy. However, I will point out that there are still many families who choose not to know that information during pregnancy. The most recent change to this happened just a few years ago. There was an introduction of a new screening test. It's been hotly waited for. We had been waiting for years for this to come up. which, unlike all of the previous markers that could be seen in normal pregnancies, all kinds of other stuff, we're finally looking at fetal DNA that's present in the pregnant woman's blood. So for the first time, we have the ability to look more carefully at that. Now, it's still a screening test. It still doesn't identify all pregnancies with Down syndrome. And it still identifies some pregnancies that don't have Down syndrome. But it has a better than 99% detection rate. So we have changed dramatically what our ability is to identify and diagnose Down syndrome, and we're able to do that much sooner in pregnancy. Now, currently, all of the tests that you see on the screen are available to women. So these are tests that, depending on where you are and what kinds of options are available, the DNA-based test is still only available to women who are high risk for the most part. Not surprisingly, as we learned to diagnose this earlier, the National Society of Genetic Counselors put out a practice guideline right about that same time that the NIPT, or the non-invasive prenatal screening test, was coming out, to define, well, if we're telling people about this kind of information as early as the third, fourth month in pregnancy, what kind of essential information do they need to know about Down syndrome? So think for a moment what you would want to know if you were finding that diagnosis out. You probably want to know the genetic cause. Okay, how do we know for sure this is what it is? Could this happen in another pregnancy? You probably would want to know what the range of intellectual disabilities would be, what kind of developmental delays you might expect for that child, and what medical concerns go along with it. And for much of the time, this was where things stopped. So the medical issues are only part of the picture. The other part of the picture is life experience. What kinds of support groups are available and resources? What's out in the community? Can my child live independently? What's the life expectancy? And how similar is my child going to be to other children? So all of this information is considered essential information to discuss at the time of that initial diagnosis, either during pregnancy or in a newborn. And so for genetic counselors, we want to make sure we're presenting balanced information, that we're including the positive aspects of Down syndrome as well as the challenges, and that we're doing it in a language that the family can understand. And since most cases of Down syndrome happen randomly out of the blue, we want to make sure we're allowing time for that family's emotional response. It is always a surprise for families, no matter where they are and what they've done in the past. And finally, we want to leave them with information that they have that's going to give them the opportunity to move forward. So that can be books, handouts, peer referrals, support resources, everything that's out there that can help that family adapt. And I can tell you what I think are the essential ingredients to sharing the diagnosis, but we have a panel of experts here who've been through it. So I'd like to turn to our panel and talk about your experiences. So the first question is going to be for our parents, and I know each one of you has a story of the diagnosis for your child. So I'd like to ask if you could share that with our audience. How did you find out about Down syndrome in your child? Eleanor, I'm going to start with you, and if you could pass it on down the line. Hold it's on.
All right. In the delivery room, actually, it was a probable diagnosis. The obstetrician didn't want to say for sure, but I was at risk, and I had not had prenatal testing. So I said I wanted to really know ASAP. So as soon as we got out of the delivery room, then somebody, I think the pediatrician on call, came in and confirmed it. But fortunately, the doctors at that time were very enlightened and said, even if it turns out this is what happened, kids can do very well now. Many of them even go to college, etc. And then after that, my own pediatrician was told, and she came down and sat right on my bedside and talked to me, said how great he looked and he was going to do well, and how to tell all my other children and how to explain it. And so it ended up to be a positive, as positive as this situation could be. But I had doctors that at that time, many of my friends that had the same situation did not have such a good initial, information. They were not given it. They were given more of a negative information. So it was as good as it could be.
Good as it could be.
Yeah,
Jane.
So I was living in Pennsylvania, and I was working in labor and delivery. And I remember I was grappling with whether to deliver in a freestanding birth center, which was attached to the hospital, or in the high-risk delivery unit where I worked. So I did not know before Jackson was born. I had a normal blood test, but it was a little bit on the high side, and I was 32, so they were like, no big deal, don't worry about it. And I said, fine, even though my initial was to be freaked out. And I said, okay, and I kind of put it behind me. But when Jackson was born, it was a quick delivery. He was about a month early, and he was doing okay, but he definitely, when he was born in the freestanding birth center with the midwives, the midwife came and she sat on the bed and she said, I think Jackson has Down syndrome. And I said, yeah, I think so as well. And then from there on, it was like this chaotic roller coaster of taking him now to a pediatric unit because he wasn't born in the hospital. So which was actually a nice thing because I had a room with a bed in it. And so we were together. But it was quite a whirlwind for me, not having any idea that I had this baby, and there were so many questions about his well-being in that first few days. And he did have an abdominal issue of Hirschsprung's, so he had to have surgery. And at that point, I was like, what is this roller coaster? So I had the same ideas in 1991 that probably the basic population had. And I went to my local library, and the information they had was very old, like from the 50s, and very outdated. So my world shifted in that moment. And I would say that I didn't have the same experience that you had, that I was working in the hospital, and I was around the corner from my colleagues. I am pro-choice. My colleagues in Pennsylvania, for the most part, were not. And not one person came to see us. Not one of my colleagues came. And it was very upsetting to me because still, like, thinking about it, I had to be, at that day, become the advocate. So when I came back to work to say, you know, this is my son, I feel good about it. And the rest is history.
Thanks, Jane. Hi, I'm Mary, and this is my daughter, Marissa. Marissa was also born in 1991. She was born at Kaiser Oakland. I was 26 years old when I had Marissa, and she was my first. And I had waited a long time to be a mother. I did everything right through my pregnancy. I, you know, had everything all ready for when Marissa was going to come. I also had the alpha fetoprotein blood test that did not detect Down syndrome. So I assumed I had a typical pregnancy. In true Marissa form, she came 10 days early. We had no gas in the car. I did not have my bag packed. We had to run red lights all the way through downtown Oakland, and I actually gave birth to her in the emergency room at Kaiser Oakland. Right after she was born, they had to take her away, you know, because we were in the emergency room. And I'm told that everyone out in the waiting room applauded after she was born, because I think I was pretty loud. But so they took Marissa away, and they took me up to recovery. And then I met, I don't know if anyone here knows Dr. Bachman.
Oh, yes.
He was a pediatrician and a geneticist for Oakland Kaiser. And he's the one who came and told me Marissa just said he's my favorite doctor. He told me, you know, that Marissa had Down syndrome. And he was holding her when he gave me the diagnosis, and he explained, you know, what Down syndrome was, and he said, she also is just as much a part of you and your husband, and take her home and love her and, you know, treat her just like any other child. And Marissa was so gosh darn cute that I just fell in love with her. I wasn't sure if I could be enough of a mother to warrant her needs. That was a big concern in my head. But then everything kind of got overshadowed because Marissa was born with a very major heart defect. She had the atrial septal defect, a large hole in the septum, and she had life-saving heart surgery at 6 months old. And at 6 months, she didn't even weigh 10 pounds. So I could have cared less about Down syndrome. I just wanted my baby girl, you know, to live and be healthy. Overall, we had a great experience with support and her diagnosis.
So was there anything from the three of you with a diagnosis that could have been handled better than it was?
Not for me.
You want to pass it back?
I think, you know, one of the things that really touched my heart was that the midwife sat on the bed. Mm. And when I was in nursing school, we were taught never to sit on the bed, never to have that kind of personal contact. But I will never forget that, because she sat down and she put her hand on my leg, and it was a very powerful thing because it was very embracing and accepting. And it just kind of was very affirming. So I think in the diagnosis part, it was, you know, everybody, like about maybe 10 people came in the room, and every person would come in, like physician, resident, whoever, and say, oh, yeah, he definitely has Down syndrome. Oh, no, he doesn't have Down syndrome. So it was like 3 days of waiting for the genetic testing of does he, doesn't he. But I feel the same as Mary, that he was so incredibly endearing and adorable that it was like I just felt like it didn't matter. No matter what, I was there.
You were in it for that.
But
yeah, I think the same thing, mainly my pediatrician sitting down and talking about how his siblings were going to really love him and be so proud of him. And we just kind of went with that. And so it really was a good as good as it could be.
And one final question for the parents. Have any of you spoken with new parents just after they found out the diagnosis? I see Jane nodding her head.
Yes, I have.
You have too? Would one of you like to share what that experience was like and what you told those families?
Well, a couple things. I would say that the first pediatric visit I had was a real disaster in that that was back in Pittsburgh. It was my first newborn physician experience, and he was very negative. And he, I remember saying, do you think I'm in denial? Do you think that I don't know what's going on? And he said, yeah, I think you don't really have a grasp on what your future with Jackson is. And I basically said that he was wrong, that I did have the same desire for Jackson as my daughter Shaney, that I wanted him to be happy and successful. And I'm here to say that both my kids are quite happy and successful. But then I did work with Support for Families here in San Francisco, doing parent mentoring. And so I really had the whole gamut of families. And I remember one of the hardest cases was two physicians who I was speaking with, and they were just devastated. And for the most part, it's a powerful thing to be able to mentor people, to talk to them, and to have an honest, realistic mentoring session. And funny enough, my cousin has a 2-year-old with Down syndrome as well. So we're both kind of mentors. They live in Arizona.
Were there any special words of wisdom that you shared with those families?
I think that, you know, take it one day at a time, and don't be overwhelmed with too much information, especially, I think, different from when we had our children. The internet can be so overwhelming, and like every door leads to another door, and it's important to shut those doors and just be with your child. And that's the best part, is just being with your baby and loving your baby, and not, you know, the Down syndrome thing needs to go to the side, and just looking at who you're with. That's the best thing that you can do.
So I'm going to turn to our real experts on Down syndrome, Joseph, Jackson, and Marissa, and ask you a couple of questions. The first one is just, how would you, in your own words, describe Down syndrome? Joseph, you want to tell me? You're on.
Hi, everybody. I'm Joseph Vaughn. And my experiences with Down syndrome is I grew up with it, and I can't put it in other words, but I am very successful, and I'm very proud of myself. Thank you.
You hand it to Jackson. Jackson, in your own words, how would you describe Down syndrome?
I'm probably like really special, and people think like pretty awesome, and yeah, things I do is pretty fun, and my coworkers from my work, they think I'm an awesome guy too. Yeah.
And finally, Marissa.
I was born with Down syndrome. And I read like a lot. And also, I like my job a lot. At Colorado Grill. I work there, and I clean all the tables and do other chores there. And basically, I eat there. It's my good place to eat. And that's it.
And that's it. And hold on to the microphone, Marissa. I'm going to ask you one more question. Just to give us a more broad perspective, I know you're in school right now. What do you want to do when you get out of school?
When I get out of school, my mom and me are looking at the programs around here in Hermita or in UMLA. But I'm staying in my hometown. I might stay in my hometown or stay in Fresno. Because I always stay with my job at Colorado Grill. I love that place a lot. And I'm living by myself with other three roommates. That would be Allegra, Eliza, and Claire.
Are you going to live with them after you graduate from college?
I might, yes. And for my roommate, that is Allegra, she's really amazing. And for Eliza, I want a lot from Eliza. Well, she looks to be called Eliza. Well, never mind.
Okay, I'm going to move on to Jackson so we get our time in. Marissa, can I pass the mic to Jackson?
Yes.
And Jackson, I know you're already out of school, so let me ask you, what are your goals for the future? What do you want to do in the future?
In the future, I like to work like sometimes like a technology working or probably like working for like I like to be on my be like working for the mayor's office of San Francisco. That's my top future goals I want to do.
That's great. And finally, Joseph, I know you've been out of school for a while, so just tell us, what are your hobbies? What are the things you like to do for fun?
Well, I love filmmaking, watching movies, and listening to music.
Awesome. Okay, we're going to come back. Now, we've started to hear about some of the medical issues that can happen with Down syndrome, so I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Chen to talk about the changes that have happened in healthcare.
So there have been many healthcare improvements for Down syndrome. And the important thing to know is that individuals with Down syndrome can have more medical problems. These are medical problems that anybody can have. So there's really nothing special, but there seems to be an increased incidence of some of these medical issues. You've already mentioned several of them. And so I'm going to go through very quickly and talk about some of them. Fortunately, we do have medical guidelines now for Down syndrome that were initially published in 1981. And the American Academy of Pediatrics has a group of experts, of pediatricians, who have worked very hard in trying to put together some evidence-based guidelines for the medical issues with Down syndrome. It also addresses social issues, school issues. But it's really meant as guidelines for the provider, pediatrician, family practice, a doc, of things to look for or to know about for Down syndrome. The latest version is from 2011, and this can be found online. And it's meant to be really just guidelines and not solid recommendations, but it's been very helpful for doctors that are taking care of children with Down syndrome. And the whole goal is to ensure that the medical needs of people with Down syndrome are adequately met across the entire lifespan. And these guidelines will get updated every few years. It's been a long time to get consensus on all the various medical issues and how to look for them or to treat them or deal with them. But it's a very good document. Some of the medical issues that can occur at birth, it's almost universal that babies will have low muscle tone or hypotonia. There can be one or more physical birth defects. We've already mentioned congenital heart defect. That's actually in about half of babies who have Down syndrome. Intestinal blockage or atresia or Hirschsprung in about 12%. And there are many other more rare findings. You can have congenital cataracts also. Congenital hypothyroidism can occur, and about 15% of babies who have hypothyroidism, which can be easily treated with medication but needs to be looked for before the age of 1 year old. So I'd like to turn it over at this point to the panel, and I didn't know if maybe some of the parents wanted to mention a few of the other medical issues that came up during the early time.
Yes, we had the congenital heart problem, which they thought maybe would take care of itself. It was the VSD repair finally was done at age 4, right here at UC, and had very good result, no problems. And he also had hypothyroidism, which was picked up right away, so he's been on thyroid always, small dose. And the hypotonia still has. He has a high hemoglobin count that they're watching. It's still within normal range, but on the high side. So that's the current thing that we're watching, and weight problem. Those two. Okay, should I pass this on?
Sure.
Jackson was had the low tone, and as I said, he had a colostomy for the Hirschsprung's, an intestinal issue, for about a year, and then it was repaired. I had moved to San Francisco at that time, and he was about a year old. And then people with Down syndrome, they tend to not grow at the same rate, so he was off the chart of, you know, the low end. And it's funny, Lucy Crane, right? So the reason I called you, I didn't know you, but my pediatrician was telling me Jackson was failure to thrive. And I was very frustrated because in my mind I knew, meaning that he wasn't growing. I was like looking at the recommendations for Down syndrome, and I'm like, but he's on the line, right? He's going along at his below normal, but he's definitely, you know, growing. And I called you and I said, his lab's right, you know, everything looks good and he's growing, and just, you know, do you think he could be? And you were so reassuring. I didn't know you, and I want to thank you now, because it was huge for me at the time, because I thought, this doesn't make sense. He is growing, and he was growing. He just was growing at a much slower rate than his peers were. But we also had, he's followed, and the guidelines are very helpful for me as a parent and to share with physicians. And when he, a couple years ago, his hemoglobin was also high, and he had some other little blood issues that they did a bone marrow biopsy to see if he didn't have leukemia, which is common, well, more common in young people with Down syndrome, but he did not. And he continues to have a little bit of a high hemoglobin, and but he's in great health. He does have the low thyroid, and he did have some major hearing issues as a young person that he seemed to grow out of. So when he was 4, they had him wearing hearing aids, which was quite a chore. They were all over the house every time we put him in. They were so, but in general, pretty good health for someone with Down syndrome. As far as he did have a case of pneumonia, which again is fairly common. He was in the hospital for a couple weeks at age 2. But as a grown up, what do you think? Pretty good health?
Good health.
Yeah.
You look like it. And I wanted to point out, too, that there are published growth charts now for boys and girls with Down syndrome.
Yeah.
Marissa's continued to thrive after her heart repair at 6 months. When she was 6, she was diagnosed with sleep apnea, and she had her tonsils and adenoids removed, and that successfully resolved that issue. Marissa also has hypothyroidism, which she just takes one pill a day for, and otherwise she's in good health.
So hypothyroidism is very common in children and adults who have Down syndrome, and it can present in very unusual ways, like dry skin, constipation, decreased energy, even decrease in cognition or daily functions. So it needs to be picked up, and there are labs that should be done every year for that to check. Okay, so moving on a little bit, this is a busy slide, but this is a synopsis of the medical conditions that seem to have a higher prevalence in adults with Down syndrome. And you've already mentioned so many of them, but they're sort of in an order of clinical importance. So we talked about the thyroid disease. This can be hypo or hyperthyroidism, and autoimmune disorders like diabetes mellitus. Mental health is another huge area which there's a lot of interest in now. And now that adults are living longer and longer, there's just more emphasis on this and more interest in research on this. You mentioned the obstructive sleep apnea. The hearing loss actually occurs in 75% of individuals with Down syndrome. And I'll just point out a few other things. The atlantoaxial subluxation. This used to, well, there are many recommendations regarding this, and in the past, we used to recommend x-rays for all children entering school age to make sure that there's not instability of the cervical spine area. And now that recommendation has changed just a little bit, and usually we do those studies in individuals who are either going into very competitive sports or are symptomatic, have symptoms of spinal cord dysfunction. But there needs to be precautions that are told to anesthesiologists and also radiologists if x-rays are being done or there is a need for general anesthesia as far as head positioning and neck positioning. You mentioned the leukemia, and it's very rare in Down syndrome. It's about 10 to 20 times the general population, and the incidence for Down syndrome is about 1%. Aging and medical issues. So adults with Down syndrome are now reaching older ages on a regular basis, well into the 50s and 70s. In the 1940s, it's hard to believe that the average life expectancy for individuals with Down syndrome was 12 years. But now, you know, we know so much more about medical issues for Down syndrome, and so many of them are treatable, or we can look for symptoms much earlier because we know what to look for. That the oldest documented person with Down syndrome has lived to 83 years old. And you'll hear that individuals with Down syndrome have what's called accelerated aging, which just means that there can be medical issues and aging that occurs at a younger age than ordinarily and typical individuals. And it's thought that perhaps some of the genes that are on chromosome 21 do have quite a bit of function in the whole aging process. There's a lot of research in this area. You may hear about Alzheimer's syndrome. This is more common in Down syndrome than in the general population, but it is very important to note that even though the risk increases with age, it does not affect all individuals with Down syndrome. So the incidence is about 30% in the 50s, 50% in the 60s. And, of course, this also is a very active area of research. And I know that the Down Syndrome Society has a very good guideline and brochure on aging and Down syndrome, which I looked over today, and it's excellent and addresses many of the issues of aging and adult life for Down syndrome. Complementary and alternative therapies for Down syndrome. Families always ask about what kind of other therapies are available and are wanting to know what kind of alternative therapies exist, from nutritional supplements to dietary modifications, movement programs, aromatherapy, yoga, a whole gamut of different things have been tried. And partially because of limited funding, there's actually quite limited information on the benefits of some of these alternative therapies. And there's not a lot of scientific evidence for the benefit. But this will change, and there is a lot of research that needs to be done in this area, and hopefully there will be more funding. Families often try alternative therapies to address specific issues, to address the immune deficiencies that you can get with Down syndrome, the metabolic imbalances, and certainly to enhance development. And, of course, women who are pregnant and know that they are going to have a baby with Down syndrome are very interested in, could there be a therapy during pregnancy that could be helpful. So what are some future treatments that are in the horizon? And maybe I'll have a chance to have you maybe address what you've heard or any kind of alternative therapies that you've tried in just a minute. The clinicaltrials.gov website is excellent for really any condition if you're interested in clinical trials. So you can search for Down syndrome, and there are many, many human trials that are going on, recruiting patients, children, and adults. Some are medication-related, like for Prozac, lithium, and other medications, and many of them are not related to medication. There is an animal model for trisomy 21, and there's been quite a bit of literature on that and research to look at medications that could improve neurogenesis. So I think maybe at this point, if the parents, any of the parents, could address anything else you want to say about health concerns or talk about any alternative therapies, and how do you sort out whether you want to try a therapy or not? What kind of resources do you go to try to figure that out?
Well, when Marissa was born back in 1991, there was a very big movement, the mega vitamin therapies. I did, with the help of my mom, investigated a little bit, and I actually bought some formula. It smelled, looked, tasted awful. I couldn't get Marissa to take it. So that was our experience with an alternative mega vitamin. I do know there's a very active Facebook groups of families with children with Down syndrome. They're looking into ginkgo, green tea extract. I'm very cautious about those things, and I don't promote them. Marissa did do therapeutic horseback riding starting at the age of 4. It's kind of a sad subject for her because the horse that she rode, Sally, passed away, and she has a great memory, and that brings back bad memories for her. But therapeutic horseback riding was awesome for her. For low tone, it increased her trunk strength, and she enjoyed it except for the loss of her horse.
I didn't do anything that I wouldn't do for myself or my other daughter, but I mean, I believe in healthy eating and all that for everyone. But I didn't do any specific therapy. But I will do a little shout out toward early intervention, which was key on so many levels. And that was, I used to say, nothing is a toy anymore, like the baby rattle. Everything is like an infant stimulation device. So it really trained me as a parent to help Jackson. So he had physical therapy, speech therapy, occupational therapy. He was at Easter Seals twice a week, and a lot of the information, I felt like it was another master's degree, because I took that, all that I learned, and brought it to my own practice of working with babies. You know, do you want the bear or the apple? You know, I just learned so much of infant development, and because the development of a young person with Down syndrome is like slow motion compared to other folks of learning to walk or eat or speak, that it was amazing. And he learned sign language, and that was also great, because it took a long time to speak, so the signing really helped in communicating. And then when he couldn't think of a word to verbalize it, he would use the signing, which he was really great at. So I think that it's not an alternative therapy, but was something that I feel was such an incredible gift, to work with folks that knew like the oral motor development. And I mean, it was just amazing. And it helped me as a parent to really, you know, work and work and work, and for Jackson to work and work and work to get to the point where he is today, which is just amazing. So that was huge, and just shout out for that.
Thank you.
Most of the therapies that I am aware of are more vitamin supplements that have been mentioned. And early in the 80s, there was something where you got injections from sheep.
Cell therapy.
This was but you had to go to Germany to get them. Mm-hmm. And we actually know some people who did. But I don't know where that went. Haven't heard about that lately at all. But Joseph's needs were mainly physical, as you were saying. He needed a lot of physical therapy and occupational therapy. His language development was very early, so he had that pretty well under control. But the other took a lot longer. He wasn't able to walk till he was almost 4 years old, because he had the knee dislocation thing as a result of the hypotonia. Mm-hmm. So all of those therapies were essential, more than taking any pills or anything.
And I just want to, you know, repeat that this is an area, the alternative therapy, this is an area where we need a lot more research and really, you know, good, well studies, well thought out studies. So I do want to get Ryan and Laura in on this conversation. So I'm going to transition now, and we're going to address educational opportunities.
So like all of the other areas that we've talked about so far, the last 30 to 40 years have been dynamic. I mean, this group has been so lucky to be where you are when you were, because all of these changes have happened within the last really 40 years, including all of the education changes that have taken place. We know that Down syndrome is associated with intellectual disability. However, the range is extremely variable, and just seeing that extra chromosome 21 doesn't tell us where someone is going to fall on the spectrum. Typically, someone's going to fall in the mild to moderate range, but we have documented in the range of normal all the way down to profound intellectual disability. So there's a big range that needs to be addressed when we're talking about educational needs. And we can expect that there will probably be some delays in reaching developmental milestones. So thinking about not just once they reach school age, but we're talking about infancy. And typically, someone with Down syndrome is going to have a social IQ that far exceeds any test score that you can put on paper. So you've got to bring that into the education picture as well and try and address all of these needs. Well, if any of you can see this, this is Marissa when she was in kindergarten. So let's look at what's happened. Prior to the 1970s, you were on your own. You had a child with intellectual disability. You had a child with Down syndrome. You had to figure it out. You had to either do your own programs, work with a school, see if they might be able to work something. There was nothing that said the schools had to have your child in classroom or do anything special for them. That all changed in 1975. What happened was the passage of two laws. I had to write them down because I can't remember them. The Education for Handicapped Children Act, the EHA, and the Individuals with Disability Education Act. These two laws made all of the difference in the world. They really mandated for the first time that public education had to be, was mandated for someone with intellectual disability to have a public education. So the special education programs grew up from these laws. And then in the 1980s, there was a shift. Rather than have the children in a special program with other children with intellectual disabilities, there was a push to say, well, my child has a lot of, this is like an ordinary child. There's lots of other things that need to be addressed that would be better addressed in a typical classroom. So the mainstream program started to blossom at that point. Can we bring that child who can get into the art program, who can get in maybe not in the academic areas, but some of the other areas in a typical classroom and be exposed to the other peers? And then by the 1990s, it was an even further push. How about having that child actually be in that classroom all day long with support in the classroom, the full inclusion? So because of those laws that passed in 1975, we now have lots of different options that are available. Not all of these are really the right choice for each and every child. You really need to figure out what is the right decision for your child. But ultimately, what we know is that by having a child exposed to a typical learning peer group, they're going to have better communication skills. And they're going to be exposed to that academic lessons that are happening, so they're going to learn at a faster pace. So there are some benefits to trying to make sure they are exposed to that and not just in that same special education program, if we can do that. So those are the major changes that have happened through the years. But those laws in 1975 missed one important group, and we've already heard it mentioned here. What about the kids that aren't in school yet? What happens to them? Well, until 1986, pretty much nothing. You had to figure it out. Same kind of things that we had with education pre-1975. But in 1986, what happened was they were revising the laws, and they said, we need to address the needs for these children before they reach school age. We know that children who are at risk for developmental delay benefit from early intervention programs, the physical therapy you've heard about, occupational therapy, speech therapy, and we can start that at birth. So once this was signed into law, this was the next big change that happened in the field of education. And our California regional centers, which have been around since the 1960s, actually took on the role of providing these services. So this is an area where this group actually are the experts. And I want to make sure we have a chance to hear from all of you about the school experiences you've gotten. So we're going to go back to the panel. I'm going to ask the parents again, we'll start with you guys, to talk about what were the school programs like when your child started. And I'm going to start with Eleanor because I know Joseph's the oldest in this group, and she kind of was one of the pioneers. So if you want to share it with them.
Yes, because Joseph was born in 76, so mm-hmm. his older siblings would not have been able to even go to public school.
Right.
So that's really amazing. But he was at the point where he went to a center that had all the infant stimulation and the physical therapy because he needed that so much. But he also went to a Montessori school because he needed to be around normal language and all that, and his siblings were all a little bit older in school. So he was in Montessori combined with special ed for about 6 or 7 years. Then he was in a special ed kindergarten, but he had an outstanding teacher, and he learned to read in kindergarten. And she was incredible, even though it was a special kindergarten. But then he went to regular school, first grade. But it was a special day class with kids with learning disabilities, not developmentally disabled. And he was mainstreamed right away. So he was right at the edge of that mainstreaming. Mm-hmm. But in the beginning, when I didn't know, I thought I may have to just do it all myself. So I did go to school, and I became a special ed teacher.
Oh, wow.
sometimes you have to. So that was it. But
okay. Oh, that's impressive.
So Jackson went to Easter Seals, which the program that he went to is no longer around, which is really a shame. But then he went to Tule Elk Park, which was a public preschool, special ed. And then he was in one of the first inclusion students at Claire Lilienthal. I would say, in general, from Jackson's perspective, his schooling was good. From mine, it was not. So I think I kicked and screamed the whole way through public school in San Francisco. The more I knew, too, about the federal guidelines and what they said, the more I kicked and screamed. I'm also an employee of the SFUSD. So It was a challenging thing. I think inclusion is a great idea, but I don't think his teachers were prepared. And it was it wasn't the best. So I'm glad it's behind us. And it did, one of the things I learned early is you have to be the voice. You have to be, Jackson was his own ambassador. He was and what I mean by that was he was an incredible person within the classroom. People loved him. He was a great student. He was a great kid. But he did need extra academic support. And like many kids in the school district, if you're not with the mainstream, you're not getting what you need. So I had to, at one point, figure out how I would sustain my sanity. And I decided that I would just supplement what he wasn't getting through private tutoring and things like that. So I think that is a key take-home point, which is... it's like you do the best you can within the situation, and then you have to figure out what you can do. And so, like, even if it's the Special Olympics or the Down Syndrome Connection in Danville or something, or the parents of friends that you have that have children also with Down syndrome, you just do the best you can, and then you try to change the system at the same time because it's a lifelong journey.
Marissa also went to early intervention. She went through Children's Hospital in Oakland to a parent-infant program. She also received all the therapies, speech therapy, occupational therapy, physical therapy. She received physical therapy through Kaiser until 5 years of age. We also opted to send her to a communication preschool that was at Alta Bates, and we privately paid for that because speech is, you know, super important. Marissa also attended a regular preschool just right down the street from my house. We live in Alameda, and a beautiful thing happened at that preschool. You know, I called around just calling the preschool saying, "Hi, my daughter has Down syndrome. I'm looking for a preschool. Could she come to your school?" And I got a lot of no's. And then I called Sunlight Preschool, and a wonderful woman, teacher Renata, answered the phone. And I said, "Hi, my daughter has Down syndrome. Can she come to your preschool?" And she said, "I've never taught a student with Down syndrome, but I'd like to give it a try." And we went in and met, and Marissa went to the preschool from 3 to 5 years of age. And then later on in high school, she actually had an internship at the same preschool working with the three-year-olds with the same teacher, teacher Renata. So to me, that just showed how inclusion and giving your child a chance to thrive can really change your community and people's perspective of things. Also, when Marissa went to school, you know, this was in the late 90s, our school district had much more money than it does now, and they were fully invested in full inclusion, and they did it right. Marissa was one of the first students who did full inclusion, kindergarten through fifth grade. She and another student shared a paraprofessional who helped modify their work and their daily, you know, learning. But they also had a full inclusion specialist on staff that trained the teachers and had in-services and helped hire the paras. They do not have that anymore. The program's gone, and it's really a shame because you feel like you advocate and fight so hard for things, but sometimes it feels like we're moving backwards. For middle school, Marissa went into a learning disabled class. For high school, Marissa, and she's always done a lot of mainstreaming, and Marissa always has gone to school with the same kids, and that was a real motivator for her. The girl in the picture when Marissa was wearing the little yellow dress and holding the hand of the girl next to her, Marissa just went to her baby shower last year. So they've stayed lifelong friends, and that's just been a beautiful, beautiful thing to see. Marissa had a great high school experience. She played on the JV basketball team. And she just came home from school and she said, "Mom, I'm going to join the basketball team." I said, "Really?" And she said, "Yes, Coach B said I can join." I called the school, "Yes, Mrs. Erickson, Marissa's on the JV basketball team." So I became a basketball mom. And then Marissa, also in her junior year, she was elected homecoming princess at her high school. And that was...
My friend Devin, she helped me put up posters up.
Her friend Devin helped her campaign and put up posters. And at our high school, at Marissa's high school, you actually had to get the votes to be in the court. It wasn't just handed to her. She won, and there were some cheerleaders that were pretty upset about that because she won. But that was an amazing night. And now, when Marissa was a junior and senior in high school, she kept saying she wanted to go to college. And so we started researching those options, and I found two programs in California, one Taft, which Joseph attended, and then there's another one down in LA called Pathways, and we toured both those, and Marissa really wasn't interested in them. And then we heard about a new program out at Fresno State called Wayfinders, and we went and had the tour, and Marissa said, "Yes, this is where I want to go."
And this is a great transition,
so,
because
yeah,
that's where I was going where, next.
Yeah.
We have two people on the end who we haven't heard from yet. This is Lorna and Ryan, and they are from the Wayfinders program. And I wanted them to share their role with the students and talk more about the program.
Good evening. I'm Lorna. So my role with Wayfinders, I am the case manager. I came on board with Wayfinders in February of this year, and so I'm fairly new to the program. But I've learned so much. We service students, young adults, age 18 to 28, and it's with individuals with intellectual and developmental disability. My role as a case manager, I meet with all of our students on a, now that we've gotten a lot bigger, bi-weekly basis. And so I do get that face-to-face contact with them to see how they are doing. And so I help to monitor, work with four colleagues. We have five domains, and Ryan here takes care of two of those domains. And so I work with my colleagues to monitor, collaborate together, and ensure that we are providing as much support towards their success within each of the domains that we have. We have our independent living, where they do live in an apartment where, you know, the majority, if not 100% of the residents in that apartment are Fresno State students. We also have our vocational domain, academic domain, activities, and the most important part is the transition domain, where we then identify how, where do they go after our program to support with that transition. And so I will hand it over to Ryan to talk about what he does for our program.
Thank you. So I'm Ryan. I'm the Activities and Transition Coordinator at Wayfinders. Activities is all about promoting our students' integration into their community and into campus life. It takes a variety of things. We do a lot of sign-up sheets and activities, so we get the interests of the students and then promote these by doing sign-ups. They get to sort of make decisions and choices about what they want to do, so they can have some structure to their free time, but also socialize with peers and go out and have some fun. They're college, after all. That's one way. Then I also meet with students individually, so we work on breaking activities down and planning them individually, so that when they are when they've graduated from the program, yes, we want them to live independently and have a job, but if that's all they have, if they're just to become isolated in their apartment, we want them to have the skills to research what movies are coming out and pick up their phone and call a friend and go see a movie, or join a Special Olympics team, or go to a museum, or whatever their interests are. So the goal is to have a fulfilling social life. Also within the program, we promote volunteering. Marissa's volunteered at a few different sites, animal shelter. Did you volunteer at the Boys and Girls Club for their Halloween party? So we promote that as much as possible just to get out and meet new people, learn some work skills, make some new friends. And then we also have a peer mentor program where we utilize Fresno State students to come in and mentor our students and basically to open some doors to maybe college clubs or out in the community. So that's a really good way. You've had two mentors, Marissa? So it's just a good way to promote our students to get out, because yes, we have independent living coaches and activity coaches who will assist with our students going and doing things they want, but we want to get away from a paid member of staff doing it. We want the relationship to be more natural, our students tend to like hanging out with these just their peers, similar age, who've went through similar experiences to them. That's activities. Transition then is all about what happens after the program. We talk about that before they actually come onto the program, because we're a 2-year program, so it doesn't take long going in. I collaborate with the regional center and with parents, so working with Mary's great because she's so proactive and out there looking at what's available for Marissa. So it could be an apartment, what job they want to do, maybe another program is available. There could be assisted living apartments and different types of accommodation. What social activities are going to be involved in when she transitions out. We recommend that after the first year they transition to their home community, where they have the support and safety net of family and friends, and they can reconnect with activities they did beforehand. Or then they can also stay in Fresno, where they've over 2 years have built up supports. So they've learned how to ride the bus to get to work. They've made friends, great friendships. They are just used to the area. They know how to get around. Accommodation is cheaper. That's a big one, especially for students moving back to the Bay Area. It's a few of our students that have graduated and moved back are living with parents, not because they can't live independently, but because they can't afford to live by themselves. So transition's an ongoing thing that every student is different and where they want to go. Some want to go on to different colleges and art colleges and things, so we try to meet those needs as best we can.
How long has this program been in open?
We're in our fourth year of existence, so it's our fourth batch of students. There's Taft, we mentioned Taft College and UCLA are very similar programs to ourselves. Slightly different locations and settings. So like Marissa, those programs weren't for her, and Wayfinders was, but we've had it the other way around, that our program there's a little more freedom for students, whereas for some that's not ideal, so they will go to Taft or another program. So we're in collaboration with those other two programs all the time. They've been around longer than us, and issues and things that come up, they've generally already hurdled them. So we are on the phone to them to see.
And are there new programs that are in the planning stages at other sites?
Not locally. We're part of the TIPSIT grant, and we're at a conference in Sacramento in July, and those grants are now coming to an end. There is, unfortunately for us, there's no refunding of programs. They're going to fund new programs. Mm. So as yet, we don't know what they are, though.
Okay. In the interest of time, we're going to move on to the next topic, which is our support resources. This is another big area that has changed over the last 30 to 40 years. This has been kind of a magical time, really.
So
Of course, support needs to occur over a lifespan. So we've talked about the early intervention programs and family coping in infancy and preschool age. At school age, of course, educational needs need to be met, building a social network with friends, activities, and organized groups, and family support. And in adulthood, we've already talked about transition from school setting to adult activities, independent living, employment, and senior care. And I know that all three of you are working, so we'll be hearing a little bit more about your work experiences. There are many national support groups, and all three of these groups listed are still extremely active, and the websites are just amazing. The National Association for Down Syndrome was founded in 1961, the National Down Syndrome Congress in 1973, and they actually host the National Convention every year, and I know some of you have attended that. The National Down Syndrome Society was founded in 1979. You're probably aware that there are many local support organizations. So we've talked about the Down Syndrome Connection of the Bay Area. It's an actual building where there are many activities throughout the week based in Danville. Is that right? And there's also groups in North Bay and the Silicon Valley. I'm part of a Down Syndrome interest group, and this consists of pediatricians, developmental pediatricians, and geneticists. Lucy Crane is part of that, too. And we meet every few months at people's homes. Dr. Bachman is also in that group. And we go over papers that have been published recently on Down Syndrome. Some people have attended meetings, that they want to report on. And we try to learn as much as we can about Down syndrome and network with the community. We've also invited the various individuals from the Down Syndrome Connection to join us, and we try to have a dialogue back and forth. So we're always interested in how we can help the community more in either outreach or advocacy or medical needs. And we've talked about California regional centers, but I'd like a little bit more detail in just a minute from the panel on how regional center has helped you out, even to present. You may not be aware of that October every year is Down Syndrome Awareness Month. And there is a World Down Syndrome Day, and it's on 3/21. It is officially observed by the United Nations since 2012. And I was really pleased to find out that finally NIH has funded a national registry or database for Down syndrome. And families, individuals who have Down syndrome can fill out a survey about health, the health. And it's a way for all families to connect with one another, to also have an association with providers, experts on Down syndrome, and also hear about research and just have a dialogue together. And so I hope that this will continue long term and that people will really take advantage of this wonderful database that is just starting up. So I'd like to turn next to the panel. And we've addressed many of the support groups, but if there are particular conventions that you've attended that you'd like to talk about, I'd like to hear about that. And I'd also like to hear from Lorna and Ryan about what do you see in the future that you think is still needed as far as support. So maybe actually we could start, with Joseph. And you could talk about maybe start with what job you have now and what kind of support that you've received. And you attended the national convention at least once.
That's right, I did. Right, I got a job at the Down Syndrome Convention, and I'm loving it, and it's very exciting to be a part of it. And I spoke at Washington, D.C. a while back about independent living, people with Down syndrome. I gave a long speech, and I got applause at the end.
And, Joseph, do you want to tell us a little bit about your current living situation?
Well, I've been living on my own for 14 years. Since the year 2000, I moved in. I was about 23 years old. It's out when I came from Taft College. And life is a mystery, but I age over the years, as you'll notice. Anything else when we answer?
Mom, would you like to add to that?
I'm just trying to think. Well, I think the best years of his life was at Taft College, and he came home and definitely wanted to be on his own, and has been ever since. Mm-hmm. I think the hard about transitioning as an adult and really finding things out there again, support groups or staying connected with parents, but you kind of always have to keep aware of anything that's going on. I think the socialization to keeping that going and making sure he's happy. Mm-hmm. I guess that's it. Okay.
So let's hear from Jackson. Tell us about your job.
My job is I work in the Academy of Science. I'm a guest experience. It's kind of so fun too. And I'm a board of director for Gordon Gay Witch North Center. I started advocating for disabled people. It was really nice too. Yeah, we study about different health issues and job coach, that kind of stuff.
Marissa?
Hey, I work at Coyote Grill. It's really like a diner. If you order food at the front of the cashier, you can order food on the menu. And I usually eat and clean the plates. I also clean the floors from the different side of the staff at Color Grill, and I'm a fast person on my feet. I work at the back. I do all the pickles, tomatoes, cutting the tomatoes. And I work a lot in the back. I usually do the dishes. Then I go up front. I usually clean the counters, clean the tables, scum down the chairs. I clean other bathrooms, inside and outside. Also, I do the walls too, scumming with water and bleach. And water and soap, and the same thing in the back. I mop the floors, and mop the outside floors. Right before I go back to my apartment, I got off by 3 o'clock, and I just love my job. I give a shout out to my boss Justin. He's really nice, and him ex my boss asked me to go for dinner. He asked me, and I said yes, I would have to go. See, a couple of the other. We have two little wheels, and so one down. What's the other one? They have Blackstone. Also, all the staff there at the dinner I went to. I was just myself, and I ordered by myself. I ordered my food there. I ordered my food by myself. Things I want, and that's it. I want to have my job.
Sounds like you're a very hard worker.
Yeah. Lorna and Ryan?
So with Wayfinders, our program within each of the domain, we provide full support at first, and then we slowly fade based on their level of skills so that they work towards independence. What we've learned so far within the academic, we work very closely with the California Regional Centers. With our program, we do work with all 21, not just our local regional center, and they've been very helpful with the resources that are outside of what we can provide. As part of my role, actually, as a case manager, when there is medical need that we need to seek outside of our university health center, such as behavioral mental health therapy and psychotropic medication monitoring, I do support our families and the students to seek that outside locally and establish that. But as far as the program, what we've learned is after Wayfinders, academic support is very limited. I think that was the question, what are resources that are needing? Mm-hmm. There currently isn't any support out there where there is, with Fresno State, there is the services for students with disability, and they provide accommodations, they provide note-taking, extended time with tests and things like that. However, as far as full support in the regular classroom, there isn't any support with that. And so what we're learning is that is one that would be helpful for our students to have right after our program. Can you think of anything else? Okay.
Okay, so I'm going to...
I would just like to give one little plug. Sure. As you heard, these three individuals mm-hmm. are awesome, hard workers. If you own a business or know any businesses, please be open to hiring people with disabilities. They will be some of the best loyal employees you will ever have.
I agree. So I hope that we've been able to give you a little bit of a glimpse of the journey for Down syndrome from a provider's perspective, from parents' perspective, and of course from individuals who have Down syndrome, and a little bit about the challenges that are ahead too. Down syndrome is a genetic condition. It's usually not inherited, and it's certainly not an illness. And there are specific known health issues which may affect people with Down syndrome for which accurate evidence-based information is available. And I think most importantly, you can see from all the members of the panel, people with Down syndrome are more like other people than they are different. And I like one of the comments that was made by one of the parents when I talked to you by phone, and that is to, I think it was your comment, that we know that adults, individuals with Down syndrome, are much more able than disabled. And I thought that summarized things very well. So I want to conclude with the panel and see if you have other final thoughts that you'd like to share that we haven't touched on. What lessons have you learned along the way? What would you like people to know about Down syndrome? What do you wish people knew about Down syndrome? And anyone can answer.
What I wish people knew about people with Down syndrome is the number one question that people say to me, and they've even said it in front of Marissa, was, did you know she had Down syndrome when you were pregnant with her? What an insulting question to ask me. Would you ask that of anybody else? No. So I would like people just to know that they're valuable, that they're awesome, and that they have a lot to give, and that you will also get a lot in return from interacting with these awesome young adults.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds like Pollyannish to say that, but I agree that I have learned so much about myself, about the world, the work that I do. Jackson's taught me just more than probably any other part of my life, for sure. It's been a gift and a blessing, and I'm so grateful.
Exactly. Again, more able than disabled, and I just hope, especially employers, could look beyond it and give people a chance. And this is the hardest thing, to really get your foot in the door. And Joseph had a first job he ever got. He just walked into Lucky Store and saw a help wanted sign. They hired him, and they said he's perfect. But then after that, when he went to college, and then the jobs just aren't out there, you really have to use, I don't know, it's difficult. That's what I think I would like people to know, to please as you said, please give them the opportunity to work. But that's right. Okay.
Thank you. So before we take questions from the audience, I'd like to thank all our panel members for all the time. I know for the Fresno group, Lorna and Ryan, it took you 4 hours to get here, so I'm very grateful for all your time, and also for your pearls of wisdom that you've shared with us. And I think I've learned a lot, so I hope that you have too. Thank you, everybody, for coming.
So let's turn it over to our audience. Questions?
Thank you. I'd like to thank all of you, the ones who put this program together, all of you for coming, because you brought a brilliant light into this subject. We are blessed in the Bay Area to live where we have UCSF and Kaiser, and we have world-class professionals like these people who will be continuing to have programs like this. And I hope you will be considering in the future. There's a brand-new hospital opening across town that will dedicated to pediatrics, or including pediatrics. So I hope. I do have one question for you about Fresno State, though. Your program, is it designed for your own students at Fresno State, or is it for outreach to the regional centers? And are you networked into other CSU campuses, which we have a very big one right here in this city? Thank you.
So, we are on campus at Fresno State, but it's not. Our students are, through continuing global education, they take their classes. So as of yet, they're not matriculated like the rest of Fresno State students. And your other question was, no, we're not linked to other state universities. So generally, the process is that either the parents, the family, the student, or the regional center will make contact, and then they apply to our program, and then we interview and interview both. Well, we interviewed Marissa and then her parents, and then if she's a good match for our program, which she was, we'll accept them on.
Thank you guys so much for being here. This was really wonderful.
Thank you all again.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.